And there are some things about Daniel which are more difficult to understand than some places of the Bible. And so we're going to work our way through that, and please be willing to ask questions. I do understand that we do have a time constraint. I will answer all questions possible, but I do understand that we want to get out of here before midnight. Is that right? Before midnight? Interesting flight from Denver today. I had the privilege of having a nice seat, and a gentleman sat down beside me and started talking about his computer business. He lives in, I was going to remember the name of the town, little town west of here that's a big gambling town. Cripple Creek. Cripple Creek. Lives in Cripple Creek. Works in California. And I'm not sure how you do this, but that's what he's doing. And he started talking about his work and his computers and all he does on computers. And I tried my best to try to understand what he was doing. When if my computer doesn't work when I turn it on, I'm in trouble, okay? But he, you know, after about 5 minutes or 10 minutes of him talking, he says, "Well, what do you do?" And here is was a son of a Lutheran minister whose family has been in the ministry. He named off all these people who've been in the ministry. And this gentleman and I talked theology from Denver to Colorado Springs. What a great time we had. And he had been scheduled to sit in a different seat. And for some reason last night, he decided he's going to change the seat he was scheduled in to sit where he sat today. And he said, "It was a God thing that I changed my seat." But that's really the heart of what we're going to do in the book of Daniel. Because if you leave the book of Daniel and are not absolutely convinced that our God is in absolute control of world history, you've missed the point of Daniel. Now, our world's in a mess. I don't know if you haven't figured that out or not yet. We're in a crisis mode, not just in the United States, but around the world. China's economy is tanking. China and Japan are about ready to go to war. Who knows what's going to happen between Israel and Iran? You know, the last I heard is Israel had till the 15th of October to do something about the nukes of Iran. What's going to happen? All of our embassies and consulates, which are burning, an insult to the United States of America, and it seems like nothing is being done. And the question is God still in control, or has he lost control? You know, that was Habakkuk's question. Habakkuk had this question. He says, "God, why aren't you doing something? Why does sin run so rampant and you do nothing about it? God, don't you care?" And God said this to Habakkuk. He says, "Habakkuk, you're not going to believe it, but I'll tell you anyway. I have this nation over there, a ruthless, horrible, mean, awful people. And the ruthless, mean, awful people are going to be my tool to judge the land of Judah." Now, that becomes significant to us because the people who are going to judge Judah was the nation of Babylon. And Babylon plays a significant part in the book of Daniel. And so as we work our way through Daniel, we need to understand that what Daniel is doing for us, he's demonstrating beyond a shadow of a doubt that God really is in control. And no matter what happens, God's will is done. Now, the other part of the book of Daniel, which is equally important, is the idea that does not take away from me my responsibility to do godly kinds of things. And while I can't explain to you exactly how this all works together, Daniel tells us that even though God is in absolute control of what's going on, humans have the responsibility to live godly lives in a very horribly awful world. And so we approach the book of Daniel, and we call this the Battle of the Gods. You see, because the situation happening in Daniel was really critical. The theory was, and we go back now to the times of Samuel. You remember the time of Samuel, Eli, Hophni and Phinehas decided that the only way Israel could win a battle was if God was in the battle with them, because they knew that if God was in their presence, the God of Israel had to win. And so they took the Ark of the Covenant to the battle. You remember this story. The Philistines captured it. What did the Philistines do with this ark? They took it and put it in front of their god Dagon, because they knew now that Dagon was more powerful than the God of Israel. Because the nation which won the military war proved not that the nation was stronger, but that the God was stronger. And so what God is going to set about to do for us is He's going to demonstrate beyond a shadow of a doubt that He is more powerful than all of the gods that are out there. And that's Daniel chapters 1 through 6. We start. First, I just need to say something. I don't have a Bible up here. I choose to do coloring on mine with my computer. So I use my Bible only so I can computer paper. Sorry. I'm pastoring a church as well as teaching Calvary. And I had some people complaining to me that I never had my Bible in the pulpit. So one Sunday morning I had told them the awful secret that I really had my Bible up there. It was just on computer paper. And after church, this dear old lady walked up and she says, "John, I'm terribly disappointed. I thought you had it all memorized." We begin. If you have your Bibles, turn to Daniel chapter 1. Now, I do have these verses written out for us on the overhead, because I got some things marked which make it important for us. But we start in Daniel chapter 1. Starting in verse 2. And what verse 2 says, "If Nebuchadnezzar carried some of the articles from the house of God to the land of Shinar, to the treasure house of his God." What's Nebuchadnezzar doing? Nebuchadnezzar is simply saying that my gods are superior to the gods of Israel because my God was victorious. And he was demonstrating the victory of his God by taking these articles from the temple and putting them before his God as a way of worshiping his God as a put down to the God of Israel. Now, from Nebuchadnezzar's perspective, that's really good. But look at what verse 1 says. Verse 1 says, "In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim into his hand." You see, what Nebuchadnezzar doesn't realize is that his gods are powerless before the God of Israel, before the God of Judah. And the only reason Nebuchadnezzar won this battle was because God gave Jehoiakim into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar. He did exactly what he told Habakkuk he was going to do. And right from the start, we have this idea now. Nebuchadnezzar thinks that his gods are more powerful, and God is going to prove him absolutely wrong. And before it's all said and done, Nebuchadnezzar is actually going to realize that God is the God of heaven. Well, we move on from there. Chapter 1 goes on to say that there's a situation now. Daniel had a deal that he was supposed to eat food which was in violation of the Mosaic law. And Daniel, as a 13-year-old, probably, maybe 12 or 13, he had been so well schooled in the law that when he got 3 months' walk from home, he still said, "I will follow the law of God. And I will not eat that food the king wants me to eat, because that will defile my God and defile me." Now, why was Daniel even allowed the possibility of putting the test out for 10 days? It's this right here. You see, the reason why the test even came up is because Daniel says, "I will commit myself not to defile myself." But God was at work over here on the chief of the eunuchs. And God made Daniel have favor with the chief of the eunuchs, so that the chief of the eunuchs actually did what Daniel wanted him to do. Why? Because God was proving himself stronger than all the gods of Babylonians. But we move on. Chapter 1. It says, now the test was over. It says, as for these four young men, God gave them knowledge and skill. When the king had said they should be examined, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers in his realm, because God gave them knowledge and wisdom. And then chapter 1 ends with a very interesting verse. Daniel, the captive from Judah, who followed the God of Judah, is going to last longer in Babylon than the entire Babylonian Empire. Is the God of heaven the strong God? Yes, because it is He who put Babylon into place, and yet He put His man into place longer than the entire reign of the Babylonian Empire in world history. But we move on. That's chapter 1. Chapter 2, we have another very interesting scenario. King Nebuchadnezzar now has had a dream. And the dream puzzles him because he can't figure it out. Now, it would have been easy for him, had he told the dream to his wise men, it would have been very easy for them to figure it out. Because his wise men had a book. And in this book, it simply said, if you see this image in a dream, this is what it means. I haven't actually seen this, but I hear you buy those books today. Go to a bookstore and you can buy a book that will tell you exactly what your dreams mean. Now, I will not read the book like that, just in case you want to know. But it's still out there. People are still doing that. But here's Nebuchadnezzar. He's had this dream. He can't sleep. Calls his wise men in and says, okay, guys, here's the deal. Tell me the dream and then tell me the interpretation. Now, these guys are at a loss. They have no idea what to do. So they start begging Nebuchadnezzar to tell them the dream. And if they tell them the dream, they come up with the interpretation. And Nebuchadnezzar says, sorry, guys. The decree is out. Either you tell me the dream or you get killed. Now, one of the things we don't know here is we don't know why Daniel and his three friends were not there. All right? It just doesn't tell us. But it says as they had now gone out, the decree has gone out from Nebuchadnezzar that they're supposed to kill all of the wise men of Babylon. And they go out and the process begins. But we have to back up a little bit. Because what's going to happen is, as Nebuchadnezzar is talking to these wise men, this is what they're going to say. All right? They're going to say, therefore, tell us a dream, and I shall know. You tell me the dream, I shall know. You can give me the interpretation. Chaldeans answered and said, there is not a man on earth who can tell this king's matter. Therefore, no king, lord, or ruler has ever asked such a thing of any magician, astrologer, or Chaldean. It is a difficult thing that the king requests, and there is no other who can tell it to the king except the gods, and they don't dwell with men. You see, what these magicians are doing is they're setting up this whole idea for the battle of the gods. And they said there's not a god who will do this, because there's not a god who is close enough to humans to ever do this for us. And these men, who had all of the wisdom of the Chaldeans, who were the ones who had within them, had all of the wisdom and knowledge of the Chaldeans, had been there for years, for generations. They were the priests, they were the ruling class, they were the caste. They were the ones who determined which would become the next king and who wouldn't become the next king. Extremely powerful people. And they said, king, this can never happen, because the gods won't do it. So they go out. They start killing the magicians. And they come to Daniel. And Daniel says, hey guys, what's the rush? Give me some time. So Daniel went home. Daniel and his three friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And they didn't stew. They didn't sweat. They simply had a prayer meeting. and they didn't start by begging God for the answer. They started by praising God for who He was. And they praised Him as the God of gods, the God of heaven, the God of earth. And that night, God gave to Daniel the dream and its interpretation. The next morning, Daniel went to the man who was supposed to be killing him. And he says, "I've got the dream, I've got the interpretation. Let me go to the king." Now, look at what he says to the king. Daniel answered, "The secret which the king has demanded, the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, the soothsayers cannot declare to the king. But there is a God in heaven who reveals secrets, has made known to the king Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days." Oops. What has Daniel just done? He's done exactly what the wise men said would never happen. And the wise men said there simply cannot be a God who is interested enough in us to give us the answer. And Daniel says, "Nebuchadnezzar, there is a God in heaven, the God who controls heaven and earth. And He has made known to you, O king, what's going to happen? What's going to happen to history?" Basically, what it boils down to. And so Daniel gives Nebuchadnezzar the dream, gives him the interpretation. And at the end of that chapter, Nebuchadnezzar says this. He says, "Daniel's God is the God of heaven." You get that? It's not Nebuchadnezzar's God. Nebuchadnezzar doesn't believe in Him. But he says, there is a God out there, a God who has significance, and that's Daniel's God. Nebuchadnezzar's got a great response to this dream. You remember the dream? The dream was a statue, head of gold, chest and arms of silver, belly and thighs of bronze, legs of iron, feet of iron clay. Well, the next chapter, we see Nebuchadnezzar out there has built a statue. Only the statue is not a head of gold and chest of arms of silver and belly and thighs of bronze and legs of iron, feet of iron clay. No, it's not that at all. It's the head of iron. The chest and arms of iron, head of gold, chest and arms of gold, belly and thighs of gold, legs of gold, feet of gold. What's Nebuchadnezzar just done? He says, "God, you forget your dream, your interpretation. My kingdom will never end." And so he called a big celebration. He wanted everybody to come to celebrate this great image that he made, to celebrate his gods, the glory of his gods. And so the command was, when they heard all of this great symphonic music coming out, and I'm assuming this was now a full orchestration of a symphony was there playing. To read those musical instruments that they had there, it was just a full-blown orchestra all put together. The music started, and all these people who are gathered here just kind of all fall down before this image. Now, it's pretty obvious if somebody stays standing. But to notice that, somebody's got to be peeking. And so somebody's peeking. They saw these three guys standing. And they go to the king and they say, "This king, there are some people in your kingdom, some of those crazy Jews." You need to understand this, that this is now in Babylon. There's a huge amount of anti-Semitism in Babylon, right? Persia as well. This is not something new. Because they clearly label these people as somebody from the captives of Judah. These are Jews, king. And king, how stupid were you to choose Jews to be in your kingdom? And really, they implicate the king as being pretty dumb for putting these Jews there, because these Jews they pay no regard to Nebuchadnezzar, they say. They pay no regard to his gods. They will not worship his image. This is now chapter 3. So Nebuchadnezzar says, "Come here, guys." Now, Nebuchadnezzar obviously liked these guys because he gave them a second chance. He says, "Guys, listen, Let me explain the rules to you one more time, just in case you didn't understand. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego said, God, I said, King, we don't have to answer you. Let's see what I have here. Right? There in yellow it says, this is what the accusation was. Nebuchadnezzar, kind of got ahead of myself. The accusation was, they don't serve your gods. Nebuchadnezzar is now in this discussion with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They have just said, King, we don't have to listen to you, because no matter what, our God will deliver us. That's true. If they died, they were no longer the authority of the king. If they survived, they had the king put to shame. But Nebuchadnezzar, in his great haste at this point, he said this. He says, look at that. He says, who is the God who can deliver you? What's Nebuchadnezzar doing? He simply says, my gods are stronger than yours are. And my gods could never stop the fire. Your gods are not that strong. It'll just never happen. There is not a God anywhere that can save you from the fire. You know the story. Did you see Nebuchadnezzar looked into this blast furnace? And he said this. Did not we put 3 men into the fire? Why is it that I see 4? And one of them is like the Son of God. You see, what God has just proven to Nebuchadnezzar is that the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego is stronger than any of his gods. And we get all done. Oh, that's what the boys say. Shadrach, they say, servants of the Most High God, come out. Now, at this point, Nebuchadnezzar says to all of the people who are gathered there, he says that everybody must worship the God of Shadrach, the God of Meshach, and the God of Abednego. Is that Nebuchadnezzar's God? No, it's not. It's still out there. Well, it may be Daniel's God. It may be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But it is not Nebuchadnezzar's God at all. And Nebuchadnezzar is an extremely proud, powerful king. In fact, we read that when Nebuchadnezzar wanted someone to die, they died. When Nebuchadnezzar wanted somebody to live, they lived. When Nebuchadnezzar wanted to exalt somebody, they exalted somebody. But he has this dream in chapter 4. Dream of a nice big tree. And the tree is cut down. A band is put around its stump. And Nebuchadnezzar can't figure the dream out. So again, in the course of time, Daniel comes in. And Nebuchadnezzar says, Daniel, tell me the interpretation. And Daniel refused. You see, this wicked, horrible, awful king was Daniel's king. And he said this to the king. He says, I don't want to do it because I don't like what I see in the dream and I don't want it to happen to you. And Nebuchadnezzar says, Daniel, if you don't tell me the dream, may the dream happen to you instead of to me. And so Daniel told Nebuchadnezzar the dream. Nebuchadnezzar was going to have his kingdom taken away from him. He's going to live like an animal for 7 years. Eat grass, sleep outside, be wet to the dew of heaven. It is interesting, in the annals of Babylonian history, from the Babylonians themselves, there is a period of about 10 years toward the end of Nebuchadnezzar's reign where there are no wars listed for Nebuchadnezzar, for all of Babylon. Why? Why are there no wars? Well, history doesn't tell us that their king was an animal. But that's what it was. And so history actually affirms this whole period of time. But listen to what Daniel says after he told Nebuchadnezzar the dream. This is what Daniel says to Nebuchadnezzar. He says, Nebuchadnezzar, would you please stop oppressing the poor? Would you please start being righteous? And maybe, perhaps, God will hold off this judgment. You see, Daniel, as a godly man, in the face of this horrible king, this king who had rejected his God, who had rejected all other gods, Daniel's concern for him was, would you please start living righteously, and maybe God will postpone your judgment. A year later, Nebuchadnezzar was walking on the wall of Babylon. Parentheses. Nebuchadnezzar must have really done something spectacular in Babylon. One of his wives had come from the mountains of Ararat, the area of Ararat, northern Turkey. And she was so homesick for the mountains that Nebuchadnezzar built her a mountain inside the city of Babylon so she could feel at home. These walls were between 60 and 100 feet high, and they had at least another 60 to 100 feet high towers on the corners. Unbelievable beauty in that city. But Nebuchadnezzar said, is not this the great Babylon that I have built? Parentheses. Had Nebuchadnezzar built Babylon? He was king, but he hadn't built it. Because it was God who gave him everything he had. Because it was God who has control of the nations of this world. In fact, it is interesting that there's another point in history where one nation spent all of its resources defeating another people. And God says, because I sent you to defeat that people, and because you used all your resources to defeat them, I will give you Egypt to pay you back for your resources. God really is a good God, even to governments which refuse to recognize Him. But we go back to Nebuchadnezzar. You see, because chapter 4 is written in first person. This is not Daniel writing a story. This is Nebuchadnezzar writing his testimony. And look how the chapter begins. It says, Nebuchadnezzar the king, to all the peoples, nations, languages that dwell in all the earth, I thought it good to declare the signs and wonders that the Most High God has worked for me. How great are His signs, how mighty His wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and His dominion is from generation to generation. God is no longer just the God of Daniel. He is no longer just the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. The God of heaven has become the God of Nebuchadnezzar. And He did it through humbling Nebuchadnezzar in ways that no person could ever humble him. But we go on to the end of the chapter. We're going to do this now. Verse 34 says, I, Nebuchadnezzar, bless the Most High and praise and honor Him who lives forever and ever. For His dominion is an everlasting dominion, His kingdom from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing. He does according to His will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. No one can restrain his hand or say to him, what have you done? Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, all of whose works are truth, his ways justice, and he is able, and those who walk in pride, he is able to put down. What's Nebuchadnezzar done? He has come to the point that says, yes, the God of heaven really is the God. And He has become my God. And I submit to Him. And I suspect that someday you and I will see Nebuchadnezzar in heaven. Why? Because God, as the sovereign God, proved Himself stronger than all of Nebuchadnezzar's gods, humbled Nebuchadnezzar, and Nebuchadnezzar finally came to the point and said, yes, God really is God, and I will submit to Him. Now, we go to Daniel chapter 5, and the scene somewhat changes. We now go from the first king, which is Nebuchadnezzar, to the last king, which is Belshazzar. Now, probably just a word about this. I grew up in a very conservative church, theologically very conservative. But I went to had been to Bible college for a couple of years, went back home to visit, and I went to a Sunday school class of, well, they were probably 15 or 20 years older than I was at that point, and the discussion was Daniel. And they said that it's obvious that Daniel didn't write the book. It's obvious that whoever wrote the book had no idea what was going on, because there never was a king of Babylon by the name of Belshazzar. And if there's no king of Belshazzar by the name of Belshazzar, and Daniel calls him king, then clearly whoever wrote the book of Daniel wasn't Daniel. He wasn't in the Babylonian Empire. He had no idea what was going on. Therefore, we have no idea who wrote Daniel. Probably written about 165 B.C. during the time of the Maccabees and all those other sorts of things. So what do you do? What do we do with Belshazzar if he has no record in history? Really interesting what archaeology will do for us. Because sometime after that Sunday school class, the archaeologists found Belshazzar. And it is true, he wasn't king. His dad was king. But his dad hated to be king. His dad loved to play. So his dad ran off to Arabia to play and left his son at home to be king. So you get to the end of the chapter, Belshazzar says, I will make this person third in the kingdom. Why third in the kingdom? Because that's all the higher Belshazzar can give away, because he's second. But we go back to Belshazzar. Belshazzar knows that the Medes and the Persians are ready to invade. They have been digging a channel, digging the Euphrates River, bypassing it around Babylon. Now, why that becomes important is because the Euphrates River ran right through Babylon. Right? And they made it so you could not get through that with the water running. They had the gate so you couldn't get through. Really intelligent doing this. Because if the Euphrates River ran through Babylon, there's no way to starve it out. Besides that, I said there were two walls. The outer wall was all there where they grow their food. It's totally impossible to destroy Babylon by besieging it, because they would never run out of food. But he had to know that these Medes and the Persians were digging this canal, diverting the Euphrates River away from the river into a lake. I mean, today we might be able to do that in a couple of hours. But if you do this all by hand, it's going to take a long time to divert the Euphrates River. So what's Belshazzar do? Belshazzar calls this great big feast. What do they do at the feast? They praise their gods. Why do they praise their gods? Because they want to encourage their gods to once again be victorious. And to prove that they're going to be victorious, they go to the storehouse and take the articles from the temple of God and use that to defame God and bless their gods. To demonstrate that their God is greater than the God of Judah. And I'm assuming, this is now theological assumption, not from the text, that most likely Belshazzar took all of the articles from all of the other temples and used them as well. And then there's a strange sight. Just kind of imagine for a little bit. You're in a room. There are no windows. But the walls are all white. The only light in this room are going to be candles. Belshazzar sitting on a little cove that side of the room. And suddenly he sees something over here. Now again, figure now, shadows, dark, sort of with the shadows dancing, maybe sort of eerie anyway. All of a sudden he sees this hand start making marks on the wall. Now I suspect if I had been there, I'd have acted like Belshazzar did. What a terrifying experience. And more than that, the writing on the wall, you can't read it. So what do you do now? So the commotion goes on, and to cut the story short, finally the Queen Mother comes in. And most likely the Queen Mother now is Belshazzar's mother, who is the daughter of Nebuchadnezzar. And the Queen Mother comes in and says, "Son, there is a man in your kingdom from the captives of Judah who can answer these questions." And so Daniel is called in. And I'm running ahead without this right now. I'm sorry. Daniel is called in. Daniel says, "Belshazzar, you know precisely what happened to Nebuchadnezzar. You know exactly what God did to him. And yet, Belshazzar, you refused to humble yourself before him. And now this God, tonight, the God that humbled Nebuchadnezzar, the God that you know that you should have responded to, this God has weighed you in the balances, has found you wanting, and tonight your kingdom is taken from you and given to the Medes and the Persians." Now, long term, there's all kind of significance there. But Daniel's real point was, Belshazzar, you knew, and you chose to be stubborn and hard-hearted and refused to repent. And because of that, your kingdom is taken from you. Now, what God is doing for us very clearly at this point is He's demonstrating to us that just like He put Nebuchadnezzar into power, He's also now putting into power the Medes and the Persians, the kingdom which followed Babylon. And what is going to happen now? The question is clearly God is the God of the is the superior to the God of the Babylonians. Just no doubt about that. But is that same God who is more powerful than the God of the Babylonians, is He also more powerful than the gods of the Persians? And so the test comes. You know, Daniel is made chief IRS agent. So nobody likes him. You understand that, don't you? Yeah, that's what he is. He becomes the chief IRS agent. Because what he's supposed to do is to make sure that the king never falls short in getting money. You know, and Daniel now is not just one of the three who are heading it up. Daniel becomes the chief guy. Now, there's some interesting things happening in chapter 6. Some real critically important things which are necessary. Back in chapter 1, Daniel said that he purposed in his heart not to defile himself. We get now 70 years later. These men want to destroy Daniel. Daniel has now been a politician for 70 years. And they look at Daniel's life and they can find no skeletons in his closet. These men did everything they could to destroy Daniel, and they come to the conclusion that the only way Daniel could be destroyed is if he destroyed him with his God. Now, let's just think about this just for a little bit. Why was Daniel, after 70 years of being a politician, why was it that he lived such a righteous lifestyle that they could find absolutely nothing wrong with him? Is because in chapter 1, he purposed himself that he would not defile himself. And when you get to chapter 6, it says that when he heard this had happened, he opened his window and he knelt down to pray towards Jerusalem, just like he had done every day, three times a day. You see, Daniel coming to this point and having a righteous lifestyle was not an accident. He had wholly committed himself to follow God, and he followed God wholeheartedly because he understood the importance of opening his window morning, noon, at night, opening his window and praying towards Jerusalem. But they've got Daniel. You know, the decree was signed that nobody could pray to anybody other than the king for 30 days. And as soon as Daniel heard the decree was signed, he went right away to pray. It had him. Now, this next point, you need to smile just for a little bit. The king of Persia hired Johnny Cochran and his friends. Because the king wanted to do everything he could to get out of this. He did not want to put Daniel in the lion's den. Why? Because Daniel is a good man for his kingdom. He knew that. And they tried all day. They came to the end of the day and these guys came and said, King, you know that the law of the Medes and Persians cannot be altered. It can't be changed. You've got to put it in the lion's den. Now, let's just talk a little bit about lions for a bit. You may have heard the song about Daniel say the lions weren't hungry that night. The lions weren't hungry. Ever heard that song? Some of you have, some of you haven't. You may have seen a movie called Ghosts in the Night. Ever seen that movie? You see, one of the things which is true about lions is lions only kill for food until they have tasted human blood. And once they taste human blood, they kill for the sheer fun of killing humans. And that story, Ghosts in the Night, real historical event. Alright? That's exactly what happened. Those lions came in every night and killed these children. Now, for those of you who don't know, this is now in Africa. They're building a bridge across a river through the dry lands of Africa. And the lions would come in and start killing people. And they had people come from India, and they went back home, which is lots of places. But because these lions would just kill lots and lots of people every night. And if I was in a camp living in a tent, and four or five people got killed the night before, I wouldn't want to stay another night. I don't blame them, all right? In fact, I hear that these lions are mounted in the Museum of Natural History in Chicago, if you want to go see them. But these lions in the lion's den had been fed people before. They knew what it was to taste people, because that's how Persians punished people. They fed them the lions. So as soon as Daniel got close to those lions, by nature, the lions would rip him to shreds. But listen to what the king says before he puts Daniel in there. He says, Daniel, will your God be able to save you? And the next morning, first thing, he comes running out and says, Daniel, has your God saved you? You see, what the king of Persia realizes is that Daniel's God is a powerful God, more powerful than the gods of the Persians. And Daniel said this, O king, my God sent his angel to shut the mouths of the lions, and they have not hurt me at all. You get the real thrust of what lions do the next day. When all these other people got thrown in there, and they were shredded before they hit the floor. Why? Because that's what lions do. But God being there proved to the king of Persia that God was God. Daniel's God was more powerful than the gods of Persia. Now, in the battle of the gods, that's where Daniel stops. I'm sure if you'd like to carry the story on, we could go on for kingdom after kingdom after kingdom, where the God of heaven proves himself more powerful than all the other gods. Now, let me talk about today. If you are not convinced that God is in control of human governments, you better be extremely frightened about what's happening. Right? While I know it may hurt, I am not one bit concerned. Why? Because I am absolutely convinced that my God, the God of heaven, is the sovereign God who is in absolute control of the events of human life. And the reason why the United States has said nothing to those councils is because that's exactly what God wants. And while I have no idea who's going to be the next president, who's going to be voted in president, the one who is chosen is the exact person that God wants for this time in this country. Why? Because our God is in absolute control of world history. And Daniel proves that beyond a shadow of a doubt. But there's another real critical thing about Daniel which is important for all of us. God is proven to be God through the righteous acts of His saints. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, the only reason they were in the fire is because they took a stand against Nebuchadnezzar. And we can do that through all the rest of us. You see, because in all those places, God's people took a stand against the evil, and God's power was demonstrated through righteous living. And two things we need to take away from this tonight. There's no reason to be afraid of what's going on. But we can't be stupid either. We have to be righteous people in a more increasingly unrighteous world. Because apparently, in some cases, the only way God is proven as God is through the righteous acts of His saints. And what you can do is you can prove that God is God by living a righteous, holy lifestyle. So two things. Will you trust God enough to live obediently? Amen. Thank you.